I was a wreck of a person at that time. I looked good on the outside. You know, I looked like I had it together. And for all intents and purposes, people would think I had my stuff together, but I didn't. I was a mess. And I was a mess in the fact of I had panic attacks. I would just literally be consumed with where my breath, I couldn't even get my breath, shallow breathing. I thought I was going to die on the spot. And I think that's directly tied to not doing what you're called to do. And once I made that declaration, those panic attacks stopped. Once I decided I was no longer going to pursue a PhD and I was going to follow my path, it took me years to get there, of poetry, I said, there's something in there. I've not had a panic attack since.
Hi, this is Daphne Cohn, and welcome to episode 16 of the Creativity Habit Podcast, conversations about art, creativity, and courage with artists, creatives, and makers. My guest today is a poet, a teaching artist, and an imagination activist. She travels over 35,000 miles a year, bringing poetry to prisons, halfway houses, corporations, and schools. She's the poet in residence at the Greenville Peace Center in South Carolina and in New Brunswick, New Jersey, as well as being a top 10 finalist in the National Poetry Slam. She is Glenys Redmond, and you can find her over at glenysredmond.com. In this interview, we talk about how to get on the right path when you find yourself on the wrong one, the different faces of courage, what it means to make a vow to your creativity, and how to not only find your creative voice, but stand in it and live from it. May you enjoy this conversation, and may it inspire you to make your thing and change your world. Welcome, Glenys, to the Creativity Habit Podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
One of the things that you say is that poetry has followed me all the days of my life. So Tell me, when you began to know poetry for the first time, how it found you early on.
Well, it happened in many ways, but I tell the story that I started writing poetry when I was in middle school, but in actuality, it happened way before then. It began when I was in fifth grade, and I heard my first poem at a Black History program, and I did not know it then that poetry was speaking to me, but in actuality, when I look back, that was my first inclination that poetry just started talking to me. And so I don't know what age that is. I think it's like 11, but that's the moment. Now that I look back in my maturity, I look back, and I actually have a poem that talks about it, if you want to hear it.
Go for it. That'd be wonderful.
It's called Self-Portrait, Bard in the Making. When I was in the fifth grade, I was the biggest tomboy. Always in t-shirt and jeans, baseball cap turned sideways, complete with ashy elbows and skin knees, and a mouth full of bubble gum. I made popping and blowing bubbles into an art form. I was the princess of the playground, ruled at prison ball, handball, and tetherball. I could pummel, smash, catch, and throw. I was the fastest sprinter in the school. I could stop on a dime and give you 9 cents change. In other words, I worried my mother. She wanted me in matching outfits, legs crossed and voice ladylike quiet. But I was Ollie Oxenfree loud. At 11, I heard my first poem at a Black History program. Yolanda Walker recited Jackie Early's poem, 1968 Winters. Her voice became a red rubber ball. She threw it over the heads of all the other kids, to me on the last row sitting crisscross applesauce. The words hit with a thud in the center of my chest. It grew, and it is still growing. I now take poetry in my own hands, throw it to others, hitting them in the center of their chests with a thud, making a team of poets around the world.
Yeah, that's what you do. You hit people with a thud. I mean, like, seriously, because I have tears in my eyes now. I've watched your poems. I cry almost every time.
Oh, bless you.
They're so beautiful. Oh, God, it's so great. Okay, so from that, well, one question is, you had actually said Yolanda Walker was the coolest black girl that ever lived.
Yes.
So what made her the coolest black girl that ever lived to you?
You know, when you're young and you look up to someone who's older than you, usually a teenager with their angst and their, she had all the swagger, you know, she just dressed in a certain way. She, you know, she was wearing, and it was, you know, coming out of the 60s and the 70s, and there was a political activism that was around her, even though I didn't have the words for that. I didn't have any of the words for that. I was a kid. But I knew that there was something about her that I wanted to emulate. And especially with that poem, the reciting of that poem, I said, that is more than just the surface. There's something internally going on. And I knew at that moment, even though I couldn't articulate it, that I wanted to be a woman of substance. And I have a little swag.
Say what that means to you, a woman of substance.
A woman of substance is, you know, someone who is not concerned superficially with the world, but concerned is the walk of the artist, that I am concerned with the realm of ideas and philosophy. And I am also concerned with my people and my community. And my gaze is that internal gaze. And I wanted to be a person that and does make an imprint on the world in a positive manner. And so that's what substance meant to me, and it still does. And I do gravitate towards people who tend to have some kind of driven passion or mission, you know, whatever it is. And generally it's in the arts realm, or it's in the kind of community activism realm. Those are kind of like-minded people for me.
Yeah, it's interesting because the process of doing this podcast has helped me get clearer and clearer that what's most important to me about the arts is how they are making a difference in people's lives. How we use them to do that.
Yes. Yes, because the arts, to me, they're a way to open the door to difficult conversations. They're also a way to find out how we're kindred in the world. And I feel like in this time, especially this time of upheaval, we need more of that. We've always needed it. We've always had upheaval. But the arts have always been a place where I personally found myself. And it also, when I use it as a tool in the community, it just acts as a catalyst for change, you know, for people to open their own personal doors. So instead of the world being this place of closed doors where we can't get through, the arts really has a hand on the handle and just knows how to turn the knob and just, you know, say, yes, here are some possibilities. Let us discover. Let us get to know one another. And I'm amazed every day at how a poem can do that, how a painting can do that, how dance can do that. I'm amazed at music, how it does that. It works.
It does. And I want to get into how you do that with poetry. So one of the things on your site, it says that you log over 35,000 miles a year, bringing poetry to the masses.
Yes.
So let's talk about who these masses are and what you're bringing to them.
Well, the masses are on very, very different fronts. You know, I am the poet in resident at the Peace Center for the Performing Arts in Greenville, South Carolina, and also the State Theater in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and also a Kennedy Center teaching artist, and then also freelance on top of that. So people can come many different ways to find me. And through the Kennedy Center, generally, it's other arts partners and educational districts, you know, because they have partnerships out there. And so they bring me in to teach teachers. And so, and not just be in the classroom, I'm actually teaching teachers how to bring poetry into their classroom. So those are part of the people I talk to. And then through the State Theater, I do a lot of community work because I'm a former counselor, clinical team counselor for the state of South Carolina. My first degree is in psychology. And so this VP of education through this education and outreach department, she one day after hiring me 2 years in a row said, "We love what you do, but we want to know what is it that is on your heart to do." And in my years, I guess at that time it was maybe 10, 15 years on the road, no one had ever asked me that. And so she said, you know, I said to her, I said, "Well, I love the community. I love working in non-poetry places, non-arts places." Then she said, "Well, let's do it." So she books me for about 3 weeks at a time, and I go to New Brunswick, and I go to prisons, I go to halfway houses, I go to corporations, I go to conferences, I do some school work, I go to universities, go to Rutgers. I, you know, pretty much in my walk, I do it pretty much every venue you can think of. That's where I am.
What does poetry do to someone in a prison, in a halfway house, in a corporation? What are you shifting for them?
Well, what I'm hoping for them, one of my things that I say is that I'm not trying to make people poets. I'm just trying to open them to the poetry in their lives. And everybody has poetry in their lives. Everybody has, they have stories. They have these amazing moments that lift above, that transcends, you know, the mundane. And it's a sacred walk. So what I hope I'm handing to them is a skill and tool of reflection. And we all need to reflect more. I'm hoping that they remember. And I always ask people, you know, what is the opposite of remembering? And they always say, forget. And I say, no, it's dismemberment. And I believe that's what happens to us in our lives. We get pulled apart in many ways, emotionally, psychically, creatively, spiritually. And poetry is a sacred tool to help you remember, to put something back together, to create, to build, to integrate, to make whole. And so that's what I'm hoping. And at the same time, I do make poets. There are poets. There are poets that have been waiting for me, and they don't know it. And I show up, and there I am. And then, the work acts as a catalyst, and then they're on their way.
Like Yolanda did for you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Yolanda was a poet, but she was definitely bringing poetry to the table in a way, in a fashion no one had ever done. And I stood up and took notice. I was waiting for her. I did not know it. That poem that she did was a social political poem, you know, and it was talking about the civil rights movement, but there's a lot of humor in the poem. So I was, of course, the humor is what got me first because I was 11, but I knew that poetry had already sunk deep. I knew that there was something deeper to that poem, and it was the civil rights movement. It was that political activism that kind of charged me at 11 years old, that charge has not gone out. It's still there because I'm about social justice. I'm about equity in the world for disadvantaged and marginalized and oppressed people. Poetry speaks to everybody, but, you know, oppressed people are waiting. They are waiting for that because they want something or someone to come in and change the situation, to charge it. And that's what I was doing when I was sitting there.
Yeah.
And Yolanda Walker spoke that powerful poem into my heart and into my being. It changed me.
It's so powerful to hear you talk about poetry changes things. It changes systems. It changes lives. It changes all of that. And we don't tend to think that way about poetry. And I know my husband's a poet and he reads a lot of poems, and it's hard. I love to write. It's hard for me at times to slow down enough.
Yes. That's the key.
Yeah.
I did a workshop last night at the Peace Center for adults. We do these free workshops for adults there. And if people are in the area, they can just go and click on the Peace Center website, there's a Peace Voices, the program that I'm over, and it tells where the free workshops are in Greenville, South Carolina. But sitting in a circle, I always sit in a circle with people because I believe poetry circles. You know, I believe in poetry circling. I sit in the circle, and it's a noun and a verb is what I believe. And people come and they, you know, that's the thing that I'm doing. That is the biggest thing that I'm doing, is creating a space, a physical space and also an emotional space for people to slow down. You have nothing to do but what's in front of you right now. That is meditation. And unfortunately, in our lives, we need permission to do that. We need to go somewhere for somebody to tell us, slow down and be still. You know, it's like what I'm doing, if you want a physical manifestation of what I'm doing, I'm putting my hand on their heart. You know, I'm just putting my hand, and I just say, slow down. Slow your heartbeat down, your heart rate. Slow down and listen. And I'm not physically doing that, but metaphorically, that's what I'm doing. And I'm saying, it's okay. And you do not have to be in your head. You do not have to analyze this. You don't have to think about this. You just need to feel and be with this.
Yeah, it's probably best if you're not in your head.
Yes. Yes, because we're heady people. And I'm very heady, too. So poetry is one of those things that allows me to just slow down and have some space, you know, because I'm a thinker. I can think, I can overthink anything. But poetry allows me to get into my feelings.
Yeah. So I want to get into this whole piece about poetry as a way for both helping people access their voice, their creative voice, and as a tool for social activism. But I want to start with your story, your personal story a little more, because you had been a counselor for 7 years after receiving your BA in psychology. And then I read that one day, driving down a street, you had the realization that you were on the wrong path. So describe that moment and what happened.
Well, it's so, Daphne, the fact that you asked me on this day, because they're doing a lot of what's going on in our, you know, world politics and what's going on across the country with these monuments, Confederate monuments that are coming down. It's kind of interesting that you asked me at this point. I was working on a PhD in counseling psych at Virginia Commonwealth University. And one of the streets that I had to drive down was Monument Avenue. And Richmond was the capital of the Confederacy. Well, every time I drove down that road, I had a feeling of unease. I mean, literally, I was on the wrong road. And also metaphorically, I was on the wrong road. I was in academia, and there's nothing wrong in academia. I'm a book lover. I'm a learner for life. But I did not need more academia in my life at that time. But I just went from school to school. I was at Erskine College, and then from there I went to Lubbock, Texas, and I was working on a master's degree. And then from that master's degree program, I transferred over to a PhD program. So I had gone from school to school to more school. And then a school that, you know, was the capital of the Confederacy. And then one day I just had enough. My body was, my soul just said, I am not happy. I'm sad. I did not want to do 7 years of a program, and it was not making me happy. I sit in these classrooms, and I just looked around, and I said, the statistics and papers, this was not speaking to me. And I ended up telling my professor, I was there, my first year was fully, you know, funded, and I felt so bad because I was leaving the program, I just needed to leave. And I told my professor, his name was Dr. Strong, which I think is kind of ironic, he was a manly man too, and I just had this moment to Dr. Strong, the little weak little me, said, I don't want to do this. And then he said, you know, what is it that you want to do? And I said, poetry, in a very small, quiet voice. And it was like I had taken my hand and balled it into a fist and socked him. He was like, oh, you're an artist. You're one of those. You know, I have a son like you, you know. And it was a horrible, nasty thing to be. But it was my first moment that I declared it, that I want to do poetry. And I think what I was saying to myself is I want to come back to myself. Yeah. I'm not in myself, and I don't want to become this other thing. And I don't think there's anything wrong with becoming Dr. Redmond. I mean, I think I would have been a fine counselor, but it wasn't the right place. Now I think of how ironic that is and how displaced I felt as an African-American woman in this ivy tower writing down this monument. These were not my forefathers, and to look at the damage that they had done to my personal psyche, but also to the collective psyche, which that's one of America's wounds. And what's interesting is that's a lot of what I write about in my poetry.
Yes.
Is how do we heal? How do I personally heal from this kind of wounding? And how does our country heal? And my community in particular, and then our greater, you know, country. How do we heal? How do we move forward?
And we all have healing because we live in a culture, at least in the United States, where our biggest value is money. And
right.
And anytime that's your biggest value, you know, yes, that pretty much everybody has healing to do.
That's exactly, because people are suffering because we're being, you know, you're being you're being stepped over, you're being, you know, walked upon. Because if the dollar is the end game, then the heart and the soul is going to become trampled in the process. And there's that trampling is upon a lot of people, many different levels. When I was working at one of the rehabilitation houses that I work in last week in New Brunswick, New Jersey, Damon House, I was talking to the clients there, my participants in the workshop, and I brought up, I said, do you know the fable, Hans Christian Andersen's fable, The Princess and the Pea? And they looked at me like I was a freak. They're like, no. And I just grew up with these fables and these stories. And so I literally had to describe, you know, about the prince who was looking for a princess. And the mother had said, well, she has to find this princess, to find the right one. They have to pass the test. And so when this princess showed up at the door, she was in a rainstorm, and she was just, she didn't look like a princess, but she said, I'm a princess. Well, the queen said, well, you'll sleep in this bed. And of course, put the pea under 20 mattresses and 20 outer down coverlets. And then when she woke in the morning, the queen said, well, how did you sleep? And she said, horrible. She said, there was something that bruised my body all over. And I went back to that fable just to say, you know, that's how this world is. We're sensitive beings. And we are being turned black and blue because of the things that have not been acknowledged.
That's right.
And the things that are turning us metaphorically black and blue. We're wounded. We're all PTSD.
Yeah. And I know you write a lot about, you write about your ancestors, you write about slavery, you write about, there's so many pieces. So we're going to get into that because that's a particular kind of woundedness.
Mm-hmm.
But going back, you had mentioned about the walk of the artist. And then there was something where there was an article that was written about you, and it said in the article, more than 21 years ago, now, which now is probably 23, 24, this is the path that Redmond deliberately chose. As a mother of toddler twins with an ever-present heart of an artist, she was unsatisfied with working a normal job. And then there's a quote from you. When I made a vow to poetry, I was living below the poverty level, but I was committed. I kept thinking to myself, what would happen to my life if I just did this? So actually, before I ask the first question around that, I do want to say, when you stood up to Mr. Strong and you shared, like, this is what I want to do, and you basically went back on all these things, like, you're in a PhD program, you are on a path, that sometimes what I wanted to underscore about that particular incident was we tend to think that courage has to look really big and loud. And in that moment, as you said, you had just little voice, and mm-hmm. it was just saying it with the little voice, but that was this turning moment. So
yes.
Just courage can look all different ways, and taking
yes.
that stand can look all different
yes.
ways.
Yes.
So, yeah, I wanted to underscore that. Yeah, go on.
No, that's powerful. I mean, it's true. I mean, it was true. And I was a wreck of a person at that time. I looked good on the outside. I looked like I had it together. And for all intents and purposes, people would think I had my stuff together, but I didn't. I was a mess. And I was a mess in the fact of I had panic attacks. I would just literally be consumed with where my breath, I couldn't even get my breath, shallow breathing. I thought I was going to die on the spot. And I think that's directly tied to not doing what you're called to do. And once I made that declaration, those panic attacks stopped. Once I decided I was no longer going to pursue a PhD and I was going to follow my path, it took me years to get there, of poetry, I said, there's something in there. I've not had a panic attack since.
That's amazing. It's amazing and very interesting. I was listening to an interview with Maria Howe, who I think it's Maria, it might be Marie.
Yeah, Howe, Marie Howe.
Yeah, the poet laureate for New York, the state of New York. And she shared a very similar story, how she used to have panic attacks and she would get her brothers off the couch and say, just walk with me. She just needed to calm down and she would just try to walk through the anxiety. But this was before she had really taken on her life's work as a poet. So it's powerful.
Interesting. I didn't know that about her. I love her work, by the way.
Yeah.
She's one of those people who makes me transcend, you know, when I read her work. She's masterful and really deserves to be Poet Laureate of New York. That's great.
Yes.
I think sometimes people look at my work and who I am and say, oh, she's fierce. She's courageous. You know, but my courage really comes from facing my fears. Those are the weak moments I feel, you know, but in that vulnerability, I've gained my strength.
Absolutely. So in this, going back to this, for you said you made a vow to poetry at the time you were living below the poverty level, but you made this vow and you say you were committed. So what did that look like, making a vow to something? And I know at the time you were also raising twin toddlers.
Yes.
Which my mom was also a single mom and I'm a twin. So that was just interesting to see that. But talk about what that meant to make that vow.
Okay. Well, I'll explain the timeline. So I was married at the time that poetry came in my life. But by the time I completely committed to poetry, I became a single mother. So when the twins were about 7, but poetry started really talking to me when they were 2. And then by the time they were 7, I was divorced. I left the marriage. And the vow looked very much like this. I went out to New Mexico. I went out to Santa Fe, the Mabel Dodge House, and where Natalie Goldberg was giving a workshop. And I had gotten a scholarship, and a friend of mine, Jim Nave, I was thinking about, ooh, can I go? Because I really don't have the money for that. He's like, Glennis, don't let things stop you. Don't let these mundane things stop you. And he was right, because I'm a firm believer. If you want to do something, you do it, and you will find a way. And I found a way, and I went out there and took the workshop. And the workshop was really good, but more so was me providing my space for myself to travel and do that. And so while I was out there, I was walking around because, you know, there's so many wonderful studios and galleries. And I wasn't just writing. I was just experiencing life in an expanded way. I was providing for myself. And so I was in one of these galleries and I found this really beautiful ring. And I said, I'm going to buy that ring. And the ring was not expensive, but to me, to spend like $50 or $60 on a ring was unheard of. So I bought this ring and I said to myself, and I think I stood out under the night sky. I don't know if it was a full moon, but my poet mind is thinking that. And I just said, holding the ring in my hand, and I put it on my finger. And I just said, I vow to do poetry for the rest of my life. No matter what comes and what goes, I will do this for the rest of my life.
So you made this vow. What happened?
Well, you know, what was happening for me is that I was doing poetry 24/7. At the time, I had already gotten on the roster at the South Carolina Arts Commission as a teaching artist for a poet. I was participating in poetry slams. So that meant I was teaching in schools during the day, and at night I was doing, you know, these performance poetry competitions. So my world, and then in the meantime, I was getting my daughters to school and picking them up. So I was just doing poetry around the clock. And then I would go and give my time away. And I think it's the pay for a poet at that time as a teacher was $750 a week in schools. And that, you know, that was it. And then I had moved to North Carolina, and I was becoming like the nonprofit poster child. You know, so if somebody needed a speaker, like at a Girl Scouts or Boys and Girls Club or a domestic shelter or anywhere, you know, I would go and do it. I would go talk to people. I would talk to them about poetry, and I would talk to them about how my life was spared by poetry, and you need to have poetry in your life. I mean, that's what I did. And I would tell them, write a poem, write this poem. You know, I would do that. And so I did that for 7 years. And pretty much my name, when poetry was mentioned, people would say Glynis Redmond, because they knew that I was out there, boots on ground, waving the, you know, banner of poetry. It was just that simple. I just did poetry. And it was hard. It was hard physically, because I had gone from, my lifestyle had diminished in some sense. I lost, you know, a marriage of 13 years. And then my home, we moved. I was living in Simpsonville, then we moved to Asheville, and then we broke up in Asheville. So then I had to get an apartment in Black Mountain, North Carolina, that I could afford. It's my first time ever living alone, because I'm one of those women who went from parents' house to college to marriage. And so it was my first time living alone and raising kids and doing that sort of thing. And so financially it was rough. Not so much for the girls, because they still had their dad. Like, they were supplemented. I lost health care. I didn't have health care for 7 years, and which is hard because I'm a person who lives with fibromyalgia. But I was committed, and I just kept doing that thing that I do. And in 1999, the Ku Klux Klan marched in Asheville, and somebody called me, and I cannot remember her name, but if I went back in my files, I would have it. But they were having a unity rally, and she just called and said, hey, we need you there. We're not going to protest the KKK. We're not going to stand and fight fire with fire. We're going to have a unity rally where we bring people of all races and faiths and give different gifts, ranges of gifts. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to celebrate our diversity. And so that's what we did at the Reed Center in Asheville. And so I said, sure. That's what I'm made for. I was born in 1963. August 27, 1963, the day before King gave his I Have a Dream speech. So, yes, I am a King baby. And I have been charged by poetry, a social political poem. I have been doing this. So I've been waiting on this call. Yeah, of course I'm going to go and do that. So that's what I did. I went and lent my spirit and my heart and my fight and my fist with these people, my tribe, who believe that all people should live together and we should celebrate and embrace one another. And that's where I feel most home, with people who feel that way. And I was doing a poem, and I was charged by the atmosphere. I was charged by the ancestors. I was charged by myself. I was charged by my belief in the universe. I was doing several poems, but I came in doing this poem called If I Ain't African. And I was coming down the aisle, and I'm sure I had braids at the time. I'm dreadlocked now, but I was swinging my hair around and doing this poem saying, if I ain't African, if I ain't African.
Can you
I'm
say
not
alive.
It? Can I say the poem?
Yeah.
I don't know if I
if you remember.
Can't. Yeah. Let me okay. see. I might be able to find it so I can recite it, because it's literally one that I don't even do anymore. Hmm. But it was one that, interesting enough, that I had written in Black Mountain right after I had taken the vow, and I was walking around Lake Tomahawk, and this poem came full blown. Let me see if I can find it. It's probably okay. online. Oh, yeah, it is. It's here. Yeah, so I will recite it.
Great.
If I ain't African, someone tell my heart to stop beating like a djembe drum. If I ain't African, someone tell my hair to stop curling up like the continent it is from. If I ain't African, someone tell my lips to stop singing a Yoruban song. Someone speak to my hips and tell them that their sway is all wrong. If I ain't African, how come I know the way home? Along the Ivory Coast, I feel it in the breast of my bones. If I ain't African, how come my feet do this African dance? How come every time I'm in New Orleans or Charleston, I fall into a trance? If I ain't African, how come I know things I'm not supposed to know? About the Middle Passage, slavery, I feel it deep down in my soul. If I ain't African, someone tell their gods to stop calling on me. Abatala, Alegba, Alegwa, Ashun, and Ogun, and someone tell me why I faint every time there is a full moon. If I ain't African, how come I hear Africa, Africa, Africa? Everywhere I go, I hear it in my heartbeat. I hear it high, I hear it low. If I ain't African, someone tell my soul to lose its violet flame. Someone tell the African gods to call another name. Someone take this drum beat out of my heart. Someone give my tongue a new mouth to part. If I ain't African, someone tell my feet to speak to my knees, to send words to my hips, to press a message on my breast, to sing a song to my lips, to whisper in my ear. If I ain't African, if I ain't African, if I ain't African, someone please tell my eyes, because if I ain't African, I ain't living, and God knows I'm not alive.
So, Glennis, one of the things about your poetry is all of you is in every poem. It's you give, I feel like every ounce of you is being expressed. And I'm wondering, so many of us, myself, struggle with throwing all of ourselves into it, into what we're doing. We have the voices, the doubt, all of that stuff. And so we hold back and say, oh, I'll just give this piece, or I'll just give this much. How do you not do that?
Well, that I think, too, part of that is kind of a compartmentalization due to fear or past traumas that have happened to us. And poetry is that place where I live fully. I'm wholly alive. And when I say it saves me, that's how it saves me. It allows me to be whole. And there's, yes, I'm putting it all on the line, but yes, I'm fully alive. So if I go down, I've done it with my whole self. And when poetry came in my life, it made me truly come alive in the fact that I said, if I die tomorrow, at least I know I have lived. But if I had died before then, it would have been a shame, because my life would have been a life half lived. Yeah. And so these poems are distillations of me, the moment of what I was feeling at that time. And I think as a poet and a creative person, that is, I am a person with a heart that's too full of everything. And poetry is a place where I can pour that everything into. It's not a person. I don't have to be codependent on anyone. Poetry allows me to pour everything into it.
And you do. You do. Okay. Gosh, there's so many questions. I'm going to ask this one, even though it's not directly related, because it's on my mind and because it speaks in some sense to the work that you do. So you know, a lot of your work is rooted in these stories of whether it's the history or whether it's current, but these stories of struggle. And my daughter is 16 years old, and she thought for a little while that she wanted to do slam poetry, and she took a class in high school. And this is the thing, here's where the question comes out of, was one thing that she noticed is that the poems that grabbed people were primarily centered around things like being black in a white world, being gay in a straight world, maybe having alcoholic parents or abusive family members, things that were strong topics of struggle that really like grab you and tug at a person's heart.
Right.
And my daughter has had the good fortune of being raised in a very safe, loving family, all of that. And so what she found was that her struggles, which seem somewhat mundane at the typical teenage struggles of stress, and were not valid enough struggles. Mm. And that she couldn't find her voice in that community because she didn't feel like her story was compelling enough. What do you have to say to that?
Well, I would say to her, and I don't know how old she is now, but I would say to her, listen to someone like Sarah Kay.
I love Sarah Kay. Yeah.
You know, because you don't, and I think people do feel disenfranchised in this place because there are people whose voices have not been heard for so long due to generations and, you know, the oppression or being marginalized. So their voices are really loud in a way that you cannot deny it. It's a very valid thing, you know. I have not been heard in this world, so now I have a venue. And people are like, yes, this is your venue. Speak louder. We need to turn the volume up. But at the same token, I work with students who have the same walk as your daughter. Not the same, but similar. I come from this, and I'm, you know, I have a fairly stable home. And, you know, I don't have that angst that these other people have. And, you know, what I tell my students, and I have students with that same walk, I say, you've got to find your particular view on life. You do not have to become an oppressed person to speak here, but you do have to find the way to turn the volume up in your own world. That's about validate your walk, and that frustration has to be, that volume has to be turned up as well, and the beauty needs to be turned up, because beauty can be validated just as much as the struggle can too, but you've got to find a way to say it and make your place at the table.
Yes.
And I don't say walk away. I don't really believe in, it'd be interesting when I say this, but I mean it wholeheartedly. I believe in slam as a mode, as a workshop to get stronger at speaking your poems out. I don't believe in slam as a mode of a profession, but it is a valid place for you. For me, what I decided, wow, here I come. I'm slamming every week. I did that for 5 years. I slammed every week for 5 years. I was on some regional teams in the national, you know, I taught 10 in the nationals. And I realized that those numbers, as my cohort, Alan Wolf, coined, the points are not the point. The point is poetry. And that is the truth. And if you get in there and if you get full and think, oh, my poem scored a 10, or my poem scored to 2, that is going to validate you as a poet somehow is wrong. What you are doing is you're speaking to a particular set of people at that time. That's it. That's all there is. That's a gimmick. It is a gimmick to make poetry attractive. At the end of the day, if you're a poet, you will be a poet no matter whether you get a 2 or a 10, or a standing ovation, or people stand up and walk out. If you're committed to this thing, you will do it at all costs. And of course, people want pats on the back. You want it. Tens are nice. But the reason I walked away from Slam in 98, I realized a standing ovation left me empty. And if I didn't get a 10, that, you know, empty. Because it's not about, that's artifice.
Yeah.
Find your voice. Your voice is legitimate, no matter who you are. No matter who you incarnated as, your voice is legitimate.
Okay, good. Let's get into voices then. I have a quote of something that says, she makes her living, you obviously, Glennis, makes her living and her life as a teaching artist with a social justice angle, most interested in the disenfranchised, that individual who has not had the opportunity to express his or her own voice.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me about how you help someone who hasn't had the opportunity find that voice that has been pushed down, that has been ignored, that has been oppressed, suppressed, whatever, find it and then speak it with power.
Well, one of the things that I do, and this is never really on paper, but I just walk into the room with my poet self, and I've been living this life as a poet. And that, is number one, sets the tone. Oh, people are like, you can do that. You know, these people don't know that that's even an option. One, just being me and saying, this is the life I live. I've done this life for 24 years. And so walking in, that charges the place. And then whatever's on my mind poetically, I lead them through. Number one, I'm going to do poems for them. The poems are heart openers. They speak directly to the heart. Not, you know, most people listen. Some people may not, you know, care for what I've incarnated into it in this poem, but very rarely. And so those are part of things that set the workshop up, is I'm leading by example. And then what's ever on my mind poetically, then I will talk to people, lead them through some questions. And I believe questions, just like you and I, you're asking me questions. And questions are quests. You go on quests. They're going on individual quests. You know, I send them off on a journey. We're in the room, but they're going on their own quest while I am at the helm. And they are, I'm making them remember. And sometimes these memories are painful and sometimes they're joyful. And after I use the different skills and tools and activities in my workshop, then after I've done all that, and it takes 45 minutes to do all what I just explained. Generally, we have 15. If I'm being generous, I give them 20 minutes to write. I have charged the atmosphere. I've sent them on a quest. I'm giving them maybe a couple of craft elements in poetry. And then towards the end, I'm like, now go away from me for 15 minutes and write to this particular thing. And do not write with your head, write with your heart. They come back at the end of that. And then I say, who wants to share where they've been? It's just that simple, but it's not that simple. You know, it's definitely being able to hold a space for a collection of individuals and say it's safe to go and see whatever you need to see. And when you get back, I will be here.
Yeah. I love how you say, instead of saying, who wants to share a poem, who wants to share where they've been?
Mm.
That's, yeah.
Yeah, and I also ask, how was the journey? And some will say, Some will say, oh, wow, I went somewhere I didn't even expect, you know. And that's great. All of these things are valid.
Yeah.
It's a laboratory. It's a laboratory. I kind of really hate workshop, but that's kind of what gets. But experiences, I want to take you through an experience. I want you to go to the lab. I want you to experiment. I want you to journey. You know, I want you to just go wherever you need to go. Just try it.
So what I hear you saying there is, like, we do this. We ask, you have the tools, and we ask the questions, and we remember in order to find the voice that is ours. And
yes.
Then we stand in that.
Yes. Yes, completely.
Yeah.
And some people, when they read, they're reading through their tears. And they just, you know, and there should be a disclaimer to my workshops. You're going to encounter yourself. And there will be tears. And there will be laughter. There will be sadness. And it's good. It's all good. You need to be there.
So let's go a little bit then into how, I mean, I get that part of your work, a big part of your work, is going to places that people don't necessarily bring poetry to. But
mm-hmm.
Then a huge part of who you are is, as a social activist, is, you know, this is what Yolanda woke up in you without
yes.
you even being able to articulate it at 11.
Yeah.
So talk to me more about the role of poetry in social activism.
Well, I see it, you know, social activism to me is a very charged term, and sometimes it can be tainted based on what people feel about it, what they bring to it. But I feel my social activism in a very different way. I believe as a teaching artist, in my mission as a teaching artist, what's in it is embedded in the term is social activist. Just me walking into a classroom and I'm telling kids, speak, or adults, it doesn't matter, speak to what has held you in bondage is an activist charge. You rise up right now. you speak to whatever, whoever you need to speak to me, speak to me, to the classroom, to yourself. That is a charge. That is social activism. It is, I call it imagination activist, but it is activism. I'm activating something. And Lucille Clifton is the second poem that really spoke to me when I was in my late 20s, early 30s, I can't remember. But, and I'm not going to quote the whole poem, but she, at the end of her poem, she said, "Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed." Mm. And so that's what I'm doing when I walk into a room. I'm saying to everyone, anyone, I'm saying, come celebrate with me. And then, you know, when you hear celebrate, you think, oh, I'm going to a party. But every day something has tried to kill me and has failed is a very different invitation.
It's like the line, you have a line in a poem about your grandma that says, the revolution is in staying alive.
Yes.
Yeah, I love that.
And she stayed alive a long time. You know, she was 109. So she's like, so it's, what's embedded in that is whatever gets you over, whatever brings you alive every day, find that thing and do it. It's like that, I don't know, there's a phrase, the most radical act is to love, you know. And so I actually, if we have time for it, I wrote a RSVP to Lucille Clifton.
Yes.
She left us. She's gone. And it took me a long time to realize that I could RSVP, but that's how the creative mind works. So here we go. RSVPing to Lucille Clifton. And I have an epigraph at the beginning of the poem, and it's the line that I just quoted. Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed, Lucille Clifton. I got your invitation, and it was right on time. Up off the couch I rise. From the doctor's prognosis, you won't die from this, but you will sure wish that you would have. Pinched by pain, I pray for release. You say, come celebrate with me, and I arrive late to the party. With my poetry shoes on, I sing loud and off key, full-throated with no apologies. With your invitation, I take stock of my non-white and woman passage. You instructed me to make it up, and I do. Follow your lead between starshine and clay, and every time they try to break me in Babylon, I keep dancing my dreams. Shimmy the limbo while I stomp on fibromyalgia's head, shouting to this killing life, you fail.
And each one of us has that permission to sing loud and off key.
Well, you know, what's beautiful about that, because, you know, there's an African proverb, and you have to excuse me, ever since Maya Angelou passed, left us, I feel like it is my duty to take up her lead in always quoting a African proverb or sing a Negro spiritual. So just that's,
please.
That's just, I'm not going to sing for you right now, but I'm gonna say this. An African proverb that leads to what we're saying, singing loud and off key. There's an African proverb that says, you know, if you can talk, you can sing. If you can walk, you can dance. And I love that because it's inclusive. It brings everybody to the table.
Yeah, I love
that. There's no apologies. And in this mainstream, heady world, we don't allow people to do that. We put them in, well, you got to sing perfect pitch. Or you got to dance. You got to take class for that. You know, where did you train? I didn't train nowhere. I've been doing this my whole life. My soul say so. You know, I would, you know, I got a soul class, you know. I can do whatever I need to do to stay alive.
That's right. That's right. That's what we forget. That is okay, so we're going to be coming to an end here, and this is perfect because We forget that when we go for the certification and the degree and the validation and the, that it is a life that we have lived. And that's our certification.
Exactly.
That's our degree. Yeah.
You were born. You got a birth certificate. That's your certification.
That's right. So, okay. As we finish, I have two things at the end. Before I get to those, I just want to let people know where they can find you. And so I'm going to give your website and just know you can listen, you can watch Glenys all over the internet. You can see her perform and it is powerful. It's amazing to hear you speak it and it's very powerful to watch. So I highly recommend checking out Glenys' work on video and then and in person if you can. So Glenys' website is glenysredmond.com, G-L-E-N-I-S. And Glenys, you said there's also some other places to find you.
Yeah, I'm actively posting on Facebook because I've been using it as a place to put what I call my Glenys Redmond poetry moments. So you can find me on my Facebook page, and it's just there's a public page, and it says fan page, but I don't believe in fans. I believe it's a place for us to recognize one another. But it's Glenys Redmond on, and there's my personal, and then there's my fan. And my personal one, you have to be approved to come in, but normally I'll let you in. But it's kind of filling up. But that's where I post Glenys Redmond poetry moments there. So find me on Facebook. And then on Instagram, it's also like a pictorial, a log of my trek around the country. And that is Glenys Making Poetry Rain, R-E-I-G-N. But if you put Glenys Redmond in on Instagram, that tag will come up and you'll find me there. But those are the places where I'm actively posting. And you can also go to two websites. You can go to peacecenter.org, O-R-G, and click the Peace Voices tab, and that will show you the free workshops that I'm doing in the area. Or you can also go to the State Theater website in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and they have an Artist in Residence tab that you can click. And you can see what my students are doing. We just did a community reading, and there's video there of the people that I've led through workshops reading, and you can find me there as well.
Great. Okay, so last two things. The first thing is an appreciation for you. Mm. And the first is just your voice. So there is a strength, there is a power just in your voice without even reciting poetry. It's so... It's solid and it's inspiring, and then there is the poetry and your commitment, the vow that you made so many years ago, and the poetry that you have been writing before and since and sharing with people all around the country, over 35,000 miles a year. You are just like, you have taken the gift that is you and willingly, devotedly, just powerfully presented it over and over and over again to people all over the world. And it, as a result, has changed their lives and changes our world. And thank you so much for that.
Well, Daphne, thank you for those words. I mean, I feel like you, with your leading and your questions, it's provided an opportunity for me to have some deeper reflection about these moments that have, these intersections of my life. I was telling students last night, sometimes, and this is why I ask them to talk to one another after they do their questing in my workshops, sometimes you don't know a thing until you speak it out loud. And my life, I've lived it, and I do a lot of reflection, but this kind of meta reflection is quite beautiful to see the grace in my life. So I appreciate that. And I appreciate my time with you today.
Thank you. Now, normally I end with this question that says, the Creativity Habit is about everyone is an artist, everyone is creative, everyone has something to make. Why is it important that each person make their thing? And you can answer that. But I also thought what might be a great way to end with you is if you have a poem that in some way speaks to the importance of us doing our thing in the world.
I do, actually. Kind of one that I've just written, and it's called When Poetry Blooms.
Great.
A poem will hit you in the face, cast petals of light, illuminate how you've been wasting too much time on work and worry, how you count grievances instead of grace. A poem will reflect how you've been a miser. Poor mouth your life, hand into fist clenched, instead of palm open. A poem will teach you that every day is an offering. Even when the petals fall, grieve not the seasons, but be wise in understanding what we love circles. A poem will take your breath away, like that cherry blossom tree that steals your breath every spring, but only to show you how you've held your lungs too tight like two green buds, waiting and withering for you to exhale. A poem will shape you into seeing how everything is more than what you have been trained to see, loss and lack of color. Not green, but saturated mint. Not pink, but jewel-toned magenta. Some sorrow, even if we can't make it out in the moment, is a mercy. You just want what you want when you want it. And like a knife, poetry will either gut or heal. Either way, you're open to whatever ails. If you come back to verse, turn it over and over again, a poem will open and you too will flower if without fail you follow.
Perfect. Oh, that's perfect. Thank you so much, Glennis.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, Daphne. It's been a wonderful morning.
Wonderful. Thanks for listening to the Creativity Habit podcast. To read about Glennis's creativity practices, go to thecreativityhabit.com or find me on Instagram at thecreativityhabit. Coming up next, Olivia Emmer on starting a new business, facing fear, and doing work that makes a difference. And if you like this interview, don't forget you can always leave a review on iTunes, because every review helps inspire more artists, creatives, and makers to get out there and make their thing.